In our first story, Behind Mansion Walls, a mystery caller unlocks dark family secrets.
Are you willing to make $5,000? I got a job for you.
I said, but I know you're guilty, and I'm gonna get you.
And later, cold-hearted greed tears the ties that bind.
He fled this country and was running basically for his life.
Somebody help!
He's an evil person, no doubt about it.
Please. I'm Christopher Mason. The story of Cain killing his brother Abel is said to be the first recorded murder in human history. And behind mansion walls, little has changed. A family feud can still take on biblical proportions.
Drive a half hour north of Akron, Ohio, and you'll begin to notice that the streets are getting nicer. Houses are growing larger. Yards become estates. And families are dynasties. Welcome to Bath Township.
Bath is home to billionaire families like the Firestones, the Tire Kings who made Akron famous as the Rubber City. Bath is wealthy, discreet, and very quiet. The last place one would expect to find the body of a CEO with two bullets in the back of his head.
Sunday morning, August 10th, 1980. Police rush to a family home on an exclusive street.
When we entered the house, the first thing I observed was a male laying down on the floor, face down.
Right in the entranceway, a dead man lies in a pool of blood.
What do we have here?
The neighbors haven't heard a sound.
His cars were parked in the garage. The back doors were locked. The front doors were locked.
Captain Larry Moncholo has worked this beat for over 20 years. He's never seen anything like this.
The murder itself was really a strange case. He had his underwear on backwards. On top of him was a pillow. There was one bullet hole through that cushion.
The dead man is Dean Milo, age 41. Father of three and a self-made multimillionaire.
Yeah, that's fine. Do that.
President of the Milo Barber and Beauty Supply Company.
He had approximately 97 stores east of the Mississippi along the East Coast. He was a very wealthy man, worth $48 million.
Good morning, Dean. Here's that document.
Milo Barber and Beauty Supply is a thriving family business. Dean Milo is a co-owner with his sister Sophie and brother Fred.
A lot of people really liked the Milo family. They were well-known and they were well-liked in this community because they were such hard workers, and they showed other people that, you know, success was something that they were going to do.
And now this hard-working company president is the center of a very strange crime scene. His underwear is on backwards. That will always raise an eyebrow. And there are more surprises to come.
Next to the door was a telegram from Western Union. It was blank.
Upstairs in the master bedroom, another curious find.
When we arrived in the bedroom upstairs to search, we found Christian magazines next to the bed, on one side of the bed. On the other side, we saw Playboy magazines. Next to the bed, we found a tissue with semen in it. We found jewelry. We found watches, gold bracelets, and also a check for $24,000 from IRS.
Plenty to steal, but nothing missing. This is no robbery. It's looking like a hit.
Definitely a bullet wound.
We felt that it was an execution, but we couldn't figure out why.
So who wants Dean Milo dead? A business rival? Or maybe a jilted lover? To help police find out, his company hires some backup.
So the comptroller of Milo Beauty and Barber Supply, who knew of my reputation, brought me in.
Private Detective William Deere. He zeroes in on the heart of Dean Milo's life, the family company.
He started a company right out of the trunk of his car with his dad, worked out of their house when he was a young fella, took over, and developed that thing into one of the largest beauty and barber supply in the whole country.
But you don't get that big.
I need to get those documents immediately.
Without stepping on people's toes.
It is not the photo I chose.
It's not acceptable.
No.
The model is wrong.
No. I don't need excuses.
Bye.
Here we have a man whose company has grown by leaps and bounds in just a matter of years and putting other people out of business, and we felt there could be some competitive jealousy, or it could be the mob, or, you know, there were just a number of things that everybody had to look at.
Veteran investigators Bill Deere and Larry Moncello chased down different leads, only to reach the same conclusion. Follow the money.
After a while, after we got into this, it turned towards the money and the greed, and especially the family.
No, this is wrong. I told you yesterday that the G is too big on that, and this is wrong. You need to change it.
Milo Beauty and Barber Supply has become a battleground in a bitter family feud.
What?
Dean's brother Fred and sister Sophie are meant to have equal shares of the company. But Dean Milo has made himself first among equals.
I got something for you. You're gonna be blown away by
it. Dean was the dynamic one. Dean was the one that was making it grow. Fred and Sophie just were there.
No, no, no. This is the wrong model. It wasn't making sense.
Fred Milo was somebody that never liked to work. Dean and him did not get along very well.
What are you doing? Well, you're not listening to me.
We first looked at Fred Milo, and I felt he had to be a very good suspect.
Except for one important thing. Fred has an airtight alibi. He was out of state on a business trip on the night of the murder. Sister Sophie was also out of town. After months of work, the investigation has hit a dead end.
There was a lot of pressure on us, a lot of pressure from the news media, from everywhere, about this because he was so well-liked.
But never fear. Private Detective William Deere has a game breaker.
I said, look, the way this thing is at now, it's only going to be that money speaks, and we need to put up XYZ dollars, then I'll bet you we'll get some results out of it. I said, if we toss out enough bait, something's going to catch on the hook.
The bait is a reward of $50,000. Small change in upmarket Bath Township. But on the seamier side of town, bottom feeders come slithering from the darkness. One of them bites, providing a name. A delightful go-go dancer, Terry Lee King.
She would stare you down, and she wanted you to blink. Well, then she had you.
Meet Terry Lee King. Go-go dancer, cocaine addict, drug courier, and married mother of one.
I want to know what I'm doing here. Why have you even brought me here?
Answering a few questions for me and investigation.
A fellow street criminal has given her up in the hope of scoring a $50,000 reward. He says Terry Lee was trying to hire hitmen to take out Akron millionaire Dean Milo.
Terry Lee King said to the guy, "Are you willing to make $5,000? I got a job for you." And the guy asked him what the job was. She says to eliminate a well-known businessman in the Akron area.
To catch the killer of a rich man, one occasionally has to dirty one's hands in the unseemly side of life. Terry Lee King is many things. Junkie, drug mule, working mom. She may even be a stripper with a heart of gold. But one thing she certainly isn't is a snitch.
Do you know who these people are?
We felt that Terry Lee King was going to give us a confession. Well, we were wrong, because Terry Lee King was very hard. She was not going to tell us anything.
She would stare you down, and she wanted you to blink. And I could watch it through the window, how two of them interviewed her, and they'd go like this. Well, then she had you.
Her pouting lips are sealed, but her past is doing the talking for her. Terry likes to do cocaine with her lawyer, Barry Boyd. And Barry has powerful friends.
Terry Lee King led us to Barry Boyd, the lawyer. Her lawyer, and also the lawyer of his close friend, Fred Milo.
You're wasting your time and mine because I had nothing to do with it.
Shut up, drug dealer.
Is Fred Milo's lawyer bankrolling Terry Lee King's search for a hitman?
There's no proof.
We gave him two polygraph tests. Both of them were inconsistent. But the second test, I knew we had him. I could see some emotion at different times coming from his face. I said, "But I know you're guilty, you son of a bitch. And I'm gonna get you." And he started to shake. And I knew I had him.
Then, another informant confirms that Barry Boyd offered $5,000 as down payment for the hit. And Barry is under arrest.
Once we got Barry and got him to jail that night, he hollered at me as the doors of the jail cell closed, and he said, Bill, come here. I'll tell you everything.
Barry Boyd names the mastermind behind the execution of Dean Milo.
It was him.
Dean's own brother, Fred.
It was Fred Milo.
He told us that it was Fred Milo that was behind this whole thing, that wanted his own brother killed.
Fred's anger had been building for some time.
They had a lot of fights. And back in 1979, Dean Milo was in Boston at a conference, and he learned that Fred Milo and Sophie, the sister, withdrew $150,000 each out of the bank for no reason at all.
Dean Milo thinks his own siblings are bad for business.
He said, "Look, you're all fired. Go home. I'll send you your check, but I don't want you here.
I will make you guys millionaires. Just stay away from me, and you have nothing to do with this company from now on." Fred couldn't take that. He wanted to control that company.
Fred and Sophie Milo are furious with their big brother. Lawsuits start flying between family members.
It became crucial between them who was going to be control of this company. And at that point, Fred decided he wanted to be in control of this company and not Dean.
Fred Milo's solution is murder.
Fred had told Barry Boyd that you get him killed. When you have him killed, I will then make you the corporate lawyer.
Barry Boyd also sells out his go-go dancing friend, Terry Lee King. Confronted with the truth, Terry Lee's luscious lips finally start flapping.
He gave me some money for a gun.
Slowly, but systematically.
He told me to hire a hitman.
The pieces are slowly but surely systematically falling into place.
Soon, there's enough evidence to arrest Fred Milo for conspiracy to murder.
We went to Fred Milo's house, knocked on the door. I told Fred Milo that he was under arrest for aggravated murder of his brother.
At that time, I looked over at him, and he had wet his pants.
Fred has another surprise. At his murder trial, he pleads not guilty by reason of insanity.
The reason he pled not guilty by reason of insanity was that his brother drove him to this crime by his conduct against the family.
The business should be run by all of us, not just you.
You have no idea.
You gotta take a good look at yourself.
Dean not only was treating his brother and sister improperly, he actually treated his parents improperly, which, being a family and an Albanian family, was the ultimate insult. He was no longer respecting his parents. I think that because of the culture of the family, that he was under pressure to correct the problem.
But does that pressure drive Fred insane, or just turn him into a killer? On May 25th, 1981, the jury delivers its verdict.
The jury was hung 10 to 2. 10 jurors wanted to find him insane.
I was scared. I was scared we were going to lose this case when it came back a hung jury.
The judge declares a mistrial, and a new trial date is set.
Waiting for the retrial, a lucky break. A self-serving chain of snitches and sellouts leads to the missing link in this grubby conspiracy. The man who pulled the trigger on Dean Milo.
Dave Harden, a 22-year-old drug addict from Arizona, wanted for armed robbery.
As soon as we arrested David Harden, I told him right straight, I said, look me in the face. I said, you know exactly who I am. And you could tell he knew that I was the investigator chasing for the Milo case.
Police have some interesting news for Dave. Fred Milo has paid out nearly $80,000 for the hit on his brother. But how much did Dave get for killing a man and risking life in prison?
How much of that did you see? $600.
He was angry when I told him how much money had been paid out. And so it really angered him that he had been suckered into this thing.
So stupid.
Bitter at being conned, David Harden is happy to testify at Fred Milo's second trial, spelling out the murder in cold-blooded detail. One a.m. Sunday, August 10th, 1980.
David Harden went up to the house. He rang the doorbell.
Dean said, who is it? He said, Western Union.
Got a telegram for Mr. Milo.
David said he handed the telegram through there. He reached for it. When he did, he pushed the door back, knocked Dean down. Dean said, please don't kill me, please don't kill me.
Please. Put the gun to his back of his head and shot him. David Harden went in and got a cushion, brought it back out, put it on top of his head, and shot him the second time.
When the jury hears the gruesome details, they reject Fred's insanity plea. Fred Milo, Dave Harden, and three others get life for aggravated murder. Milo's attorney, Barry Boyd, the go-go dancer Terry Lee King, and four others are found guilty of conspiracy and get lighter terms.
Fred passed away when he was in prison in 1998. He died of a heart attack. Terry Lee King died of breast cancer.
The biblical story goes like this. Cain slew his brother Abel, then God cursed him so he'd never grow another crop of grain. And so Fred Milo was cursed. Without his brother Dean, the Milo Beauty and Barber Supply Company collapsed. And all the family had built turned to dust.
Fred was responsible for killing his brother and taking a company that was worth $48 million to being basically bankrupt to $1.5 million when it was sold.
If you go to Akron, Ohio, go out to the buildings now closed, and you see a broken sign just swaying in the wind, Milo Beauty and Barber Supply.
I'm talking to you!
Still to come, behind mansion walls.
When I walked into the house, I found myself in the scene of an extremely violent crime.
Who would gun down a wealthy family?
At the beginning, we were looking for that needle in the haystack.
Who stands to gain?
Donald was very unforgiving.
No!
He made a lot of enemies in the business that he was in.
In the world of the wealthy, there are different kinds of money. Old money, new money, and discreet money. The kind you find here, in the tranquil streets of Munster, Indiana.
I think a lot of people have moved here or live in this community because of the safety and the good schools and just the community atmosphere that we have in our little town.
Very affluent neighborhood, beautiful homes, big trees, you know, a very well-established neighborhood outside of Chicago. Not known for violent crime at all.
Help! Help!
Until November 9th, 1989.
Somebody help!
When a blood-spattered man goes running down 35th Street.
He was bleeding pretty bad.
Help! He shot my mom!
That just doesn't happen in a place like Munster.
There was a bit of a panic because they saw this guy coming in with blood all over. And he was trying to get a telephone.
That blood-stained young man is Mark Levine. Shot dead on the floor of the family home are his parents, Don and Marcia. Mark is the only survivor and heir to a family fortune of $25 million.
Is it okay if I talk to you?
Yes, please.
When police arrive, Yale law graduate Mark Levine tries to make sense of what happened. That morning, the family planned to drive to Chicago, where Mark was to be sworn in to the Illinois bar. At around 8:50 a.m., there's a knock at the door.
Hello?
I've got a delivery for you.
Oh, sure.
You'll need to sign for it.
Yeah, okay.
In his hand, he had the FedEx package. He also had a Ruger 357 Magnum six-shot revolver.
Down on the ground, don't see anything.
Okay.
The individual produced a gun.
Get down!
Okay.
The delivery man struck him over the head with the butt of the gun.
And Mark Levine is briefly knocked out, only to be woken by gunfire.
It was very brutal. Both of the Levines were shot twice at close range with, we determined to be a 357 handgun. By this time, the son, Mark, had actually gotten up, gotten his balance, and was running across the street.
Help! Somebody help! I shot my mom!
When I walked into the house, I found myself in the scene of an extremely violent crime. There was no evidence that anything had been taken from the house as a result of a robbery. And the purpose of the person who shot him was for no other reason than to kill him.
The Munster PD has a suburban assassination on its hands. And the first question is, who would want Don and Marsha Levine dead?
They were people that had money and that they were well known in the community as being a very upstanding family.
Donald Levine had a reputation of being a successful businessman.
Well, we have 3 weeks, 3 weeks to get this shopping center up and running.
He had interests in gold mines, and he was involved in numerous real estate ventures in a number of states.
I'm telling you, I'm in charge here.
Donald was a very, very shrewd businessman, and that's how he accumulated his wealth and fortune.
But Donald Levine didn't amass his fortune by being Mr. Nice Guy. In business, he was ruthless, making enemies as easily as he made profits. His sister-in-law gave him a nickname, Darth Vader.
I've told you so many times, you're not listening.
I mean, Donald was a very abrupt.
No, no!
Unforgiving.
I'm sick of talking to you.
And he made a lot of enemies in the business that he was in.
Who did Donald make mad enough to do this to him?
Donald's little brother, Robert, runs the Arizona arm of his real estate empire. You want enemies of Don Levine? He's got quite a list.
He said his brother was involved in business dealings with members of La Cosa Nostra.
If you don't like it, you can hit the highway.
That he had made some enemies in the real estate business, had taken advantage of certain situations, and the people that he had taken advantage of had a score to settle with him.
This double murder investigation could take a while.
He's got this. He's got a gun.
At the beginning, we were looking for that needle in a haystack.
And he hit me.
But
so
there's
hard.
A nagging question.
People said, well, how come he only hit him on the head? How come he didn't shoot him?
And then he went.
Why is the son, Mark Levine, still alive? The answer to that came special delivery.
On that FedEx package were fingerprints.
And that was really the key piece of evidence right there.
November 1989. Indiana millionaire Don Levine and his wife Marsha are shot dead in their own home. Their only child, Mark, makes a lucky escape.
He gave us not a good, but an excellent physical description of the person who killed his parents.
He was, you know, about a head higher and a beard.
He looked like Grizzly Adams, you know, the former TV show. He had this big, bushy beard, almost like a mountain-type man. He was a big, huge guy.
The Grizzly Adams killer, a giant of a man. It's certainly a frightening description, but it still doesn't answer the question. Why was he there? Why did this bearded monster let an eyewitness live to tell the tale?
Mark was a suspect because he would have stood to benefit from the death of his parents, because he would have been left with the estate.
They were financially well off to the extent around $25 million value.
The biggest clues in this murder mystery have been accidentally left behind by the killer.
The killer runs out of the house. He forgets about the package that's laying on the floor.
The package is the hitman's prop for his disguise as a delivery man. It's covered in fingerprints, and it contains an important clue, a map.
On the map, it basically shows the route from Midway Airport to the house in Munster. That pointed us in the direction of that this person probably flew in. If he flew in, he needed a vehicle.
Eyewitnesses in the neighborhood saw the killer drive off in a Chevy Corsica. You can rent those from Chicago's Midway Airport. Detectives start sifting through thousands of rental records.
One of them jumped out at us that this isn't right. And that record came back that Robert Levine had rented a car on the night before the murder from one of the major airports in Chicago.
Robert Levine, Donald Levine's younger brother and business partner.
When we started looking at Donald and Robert, we noticed that they weren't the both loving brothers that was originally portrayed.
In the aftermath of the murders, Robert Levine told investigators he was devastated by his brother's death and very concerned about his nephew, Mark. He did neglect to mention one thing, however. A few months earlier, he and Don had a brotherly brawl that can only be described as apocalyptic.
Robert, look at the figures.
Donald found out and believed that Robert had embezzled some money, significant money, from the company.
What is going on?
Look at
those
figures. Donald Levine told any and everybody that would listen that his brother was a thief and that he should go to jail.
Donald came down very hard on Robert, and Donald ended up making him back to just a paid employee. So he went from being an equal to being someone that worked for his brother.
Get out of here! Get out of here!
His pride injured, his bank balance hurt. Robert Levine has many reasons to hate his brother. But on the morning of the murders, he is 1,600 miles away in Phoenix, Arizona.
Robert clearly said, I was in Arizona. I didn't have anything to do with this.
And the getaway car rented on his credit card? Robert explains that card had been stolen. But the detectives from Munster, Indiana, are methodical, tenacious police officers. They will check every detail, no matter how small.
So when we get a copy of that rental agreement and it gets down to the line where they need a home phone number, and that's probably where our first big break came in.
The telephone number did not match Robert Levine's.
The phone number comes back to Bruce McKinney. And Bruce McKinney is somebody we hadn't heard about ever before.
But Bruce McKinney is known to Arizona police, who'd once arrested him in a minor drug bust. He has a record.
Inside his arrest file was his photograph.
He also has a beard. Just like the man Mark Levine described as the killer.
One of the best matches I've ever seen in my career.
The arrest file also holds Bruce McKinney's fingerprints.
They were a perfect match for the prints that were on the package.
Hello?
Within days, McKinney is under arrest again and under immense pressure to save his own skin.
We had a darn good case, and they were going to go after the death penalty.
Bruce denies anyone else was involved. Even though his rental car was secured with Robert Levine's credit card. But Don Levine's surviving son, Mark, is also having trouble coming up with answers.
Did you ever tell your Uncle Robert that you'd like to kill your father?
There was conflicting testimony from various eyewitnesses about whether the assassin left before Mark or after Mark?
No, nothing that was said seriously.
He did not attend his parents' funeral.
There's a difference between saying something and actually meaning it.
Which raised a lot of, suspicion.
Do you know Bruce McKinney?
No.
And they gave him a polygraph examination, which the polygraph examiner had concluded was inconclusive.
Capturing the gunman will not be sufficient in this case. Detectives must find the hand that pulls the strings. It looks like a family affair, but who? The brother or the son? One of them is about to lose his nerve and show his hand.
He knew that we were coming after him. It was pretty obvious. And at that point in time, he disappeared.
At age 40, Bruce McKinney has made a deal with the devil.
Now you're going to tell me why you know right now.
For the promise of $1 million. But who is that devil? Now he must decide if his soul and his life are worth saving.
Do you really want to go to jail for a couple of rich guys? Really?
You know, the case against Bruce McKinney was extremely strong. He was looking at the death penalty for the double murder.
Right here. Your fingerprints again. These were inside.
Does McKinney tell police who paid him to shoot Don and Marsha Levine?
If you testify, you'll not get the death penalty.
Or does he become a dead man walking?
Your signature.
In the end, his choice is easy.
I promise.
Bruce McKinney told us that the reason for the whole murder was being hired by Robert Levine to kill Donald, Marsha, and Mark, so that Robert would inherit Donald's estate.
Bruce McKinney's confession is chilling. Robert Levine had groomed him for months, meticulously planning the murders. Robert would never have to put up with his brother's bullying ways again. At last, he would be king of the Levine Empire and all of its riches.
Anger, greed, murder, and revenge. That really embodied what the case was all about.
It's the typical Cain and Abel story where one brother wanted what the other brother had.
When Donald Levine stripped Robert of all his power in their real estate firm, something changed in Robert. And his brother became a marked man.
He was prepared to carry out whatever it took to change the circumstances he was in, which included the death of his brother and sister-in-law and nephew.
Robert knows one person who just might be able to carry out a hit, a reliable, resourceful chap. He's the handyman who works on some of his properties, Bruce McKinney.
Bruce kind of alludes that he's bigger than a handyman and he is actually a hitman or is willing to do a hit, where he was in the military and he had these big jobs for special forces in the military.
None of that is true. Bruce really is more handyman than hitman. But he likes the sound of $1 million payday. On November 9th, 1989, he's ready and willing to kill. Robert Levine has planned this to a T.
Hello?
Every terrible detail.
The order of death by the killer had to be in a certain sequence. The sister-in-law, the nephew, and then the brother.
If Donald or his son, Mark, were the last to die, the money would then all go to Robert's side of the family. If his wife was the last one to expire, then the money would then revert to her side of the family.
And that is why Mark Levine survived the attack. His Uncle Robert's vicious greed saved his life.
Just don't hurt me, please.
He was hit very hard to knock him out, hoping that when he could go in and find Donald and Marcia, he could take care of them and then come back, Mark would still be there.
Right around that time that he was hitting Mark, Marcia Levine came around the corner.
And at that point in time, the delivery man shot her in the chest. The husband came barreling out of the bathroom. He shot him once in the side.
He went over to him at point blank range, fired another shot into his head. He went back to Marcia Levine, almost point blank range, and put one in her head.
And when Bruce McKinney returns to finish the job, Mark has made his lucky escape.
I shot my mom! Help!
After all this planning, Bruce has botched the job.
He hits the car like, damn, I didn't get all of them like I was supposed to.
With Bruce McKinney's confession and irrefutable evidence, the FBI swoop in to arrest Robert Levine. But they're too late.
Robert took off and ran on us. The FBI had him as a wanted fugitive. He was going back and forth in California, into Mexico, and living the life on the run.
5 months later, Robert Levine finally surrenders. In October 1991, he is convicted of conspiracy and murder and sentenced to life in prison.
Robert Levine was and is an evil person, no doubt about it. To do what he did, evil.
And Bruce McKinney, the hapless, bearded handyman turned hitman, gets 45 years. In prison, he is in witness protection. But the son who got away will never forget the grisly face of greed.
To have witnessed your own parents brutally murdered in your own home and having to find out that his own uncle was responsible is almost beyond comprehension.
Brother against brother with murderous intent. The Old Testament tale of Cain and Abel doomed to repeat itself. Fred Milo's jealousy and greed became a motive for murder. Robert Levine lived in the shadow of his brother until he arranged to have him killed. Jealousy may ignite a family feud. Naked greed will take it to the grave. Till next we meet, behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.